business model which is integrated with a militarized approach to policing.
Wow. And what are the next steps then, now that this boat has been seized and the activists are apparently in Israeli prison?
Yeah, well, they're being processed, as they say, which means interrogated and searched, and, you know, sort of repeated and quite unnecessary, humiliating searches, because they know they haven't got anything, and they've already determined that they haven't got anything by now. But they still subject them to repeated searches because they can, let's face it. There has been, as I say, initial contact with our people in Ashdod. We're hoping, we always hope for a smooth or quick deportation. We hope that they will stick together. Of course, the case of the Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, Bazil Ghattas, that's particularly interesting. He's not going to be deported. There's calls for him to lose his parliamentary immunity or be charged with something in Israel, because this is a big issue in Israel about whether the Palestinians who are the Israeli citizens, who are, you know, about 20% of Israeli citizens are Palestinians, you know, whether they have the right to politically stand up for their own people who are being subjected to this blockade. But for the rest of the internationals, which include, you know, a former president of Tunisia and former or sitting members of European Parliament, we, as well as activists and other people from different parts of the world, we expect them to be, we hope they'll be deported quickly, within 24 to 48 hours. In the case of Canada, we have a retired marine engineer and a university professor who's also a retired or former chief of the Ardoc Algonquin First Nations here in Ontario. So Bob Lovelace is a... he's an Indigenous leader, and his view of this, he's got an anti-colonial view of solidarity from Turtle Island to Palestine. And he tried to travel with us in 2011. He wasn't able to get on board finally. We were blockaded in Greece, as I said. But the way Bob views this is that he says he's sailing to the largest Indian reservation in the world, and the restrictions on movement and restrictions on the economy that Palestinians are subject to in Gaza, for him, remind him of another generation of the paternalistic colonial states repression of First Nations in Canada and the U.S.
Well, we will leave it there. Again, I've been speaking with David Heap. He is with the Canadian Boat to Gaza, one of the groups organizing the Freedom Flotilla, which has been on its way to Gaza over the past weekend until one of the four boats were seized by the Israeli military. The other three boats then turned back to European waters. David, thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Tune in to KBOO for the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Tuesday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th. From noon to 10 p.m., we'll be broadcasting live from the festival. Oregon community media stations in Ashland, Astoria, Bend, Cottage Grove, Newport, Salem, and Warm Springs will also be carrying the festival, as well as KBOO in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis. So tune in July 2nd through the 5th, noon to 10 p.m., for the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival on Oregon Community Media and your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
The time is 6:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO, Portland. Coming up next, it's Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er. Just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Lane Ponce. I'm your co-host this evening for the Labor Radio Show. Welcome. And my guest co-host with me tonight is Susan Stoner. Susan, it's good to have you here.
Yep, it's great to be here, Lynn.
Thank you for coming. And who would you like to introduce?
Well, I want to introduce our special guest. Her name is Caroline Miller. And she's special to me for a number of reasons. One is she was my high school English teacher. And she's one of those teachers that as you got older, you always remembered fondly. Of course, she doesn't remember me. She taught so many students. But anyway, we've reconnected. And after that, after she was a teacher in high school, then she was a union president for the teachers union, a metro counselor, a Multnomah County commissioner. She is also a painter and a writer of Gothic suspense novels, and she has a fantastic blog that she manages to put out, about what, 4 times a week?
5 times a week, Monday through Friday.
Yeah, and so, Caroline.
Well, it's great to be here, Lane. Thank you for letting me be here. I'm cheating with Susan because we're both writers.
Yes.
I also write plays, and Susan, of course, writes that wonderful Sage Adair Pacific Northwest Mystery Series, and we co-host a program on YouTube called Just Read It. We put out a book review about every 2 months, so we invite people to join us on Just Read It.
Oh, I don't know about that. It's a how do you log on to Just Read It? You just put
just
that
get
in
on to YouTube and write Just Read It, and you'll find us, or Susan's name and mine.
So it's book reviews?
Yep,
book reviews.
Okay, what's your most recent book review?
That's been published, that's online, or the one we have them in the can, sort of. So
yeah, the Light Between Oceans, I think, is coming up next. So, and The Gods
of Second Chances
are just coming up. So, two great books. People want to come and listen.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information. And we're waiting for perhaps a call in pretty soon, and we will talk about how technology affects unions and workers. Is that good?
That sounds great, and it better be, because that's what I did my homework on.
And if you did, you do sound like a teacher, a well-prepared teacher.
Well, Lane, the thing is, because I do write these blogs that Susan talks about, which is the writer's view of life and what other writers have to say, I have to do a lot of reading. And my heart is still with labor. And what I see a lot, Susan, you probably noticed, is the growth of technology. We've got a new industrial wave coming on, or a social revolution, that is probably going to be a tsunami for the worker. What do you think, Susan?
I think that's probably...
What we have right now is a person calling in, Mr. Tom Lux, who is the president of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and he has ideas about the future of unions also and the history of unions. Tom, good evening.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Great.
We're about to launch into a really heated discussion about technology and the workers. Where do you think the historic perspective comes in on that?
Well, historically, I mean, we've seen how technology has totally changed the workplace and our communities. And like anything with history, it's good to know history, to learn from it, so we can see and help develop where we're going.
And as the newly elected president of the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, how do you see the role of that organization?
Well, the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association is 47 years old now, and we've been active in observing and studying history as well as the current events and how history relates to the current events and the future. And we will continue doing that. We hope to expand a bit, though. I'm encouraging our members to get newer members involved and get fresher ideas, and so we can deal with the changes that are going on right now, as well as look to the past to give us some guidance.
I think the organization has also really provided good leadership in terms of preserving history, especially through the oral history projects that you've undertaken.
Absolutely. Oregon especially has a very great oral history project. We've done some in Washington as well. And that just is a great way to preserve, you know, from the voices of the people who lived it, what went on and what their perspective was. It's just a lot better than trying to read a book.
Yeah, well, reading books good too, but also, Tom, some of the things that happened throughout the year with the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, the conference is very important, and also invites academics to submit material. How does that work?
We have every year we have a membership conference, and we cover Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, and we rotate who sponsors the conference that year. This year, Washington State was the sponsor, and we had a really good conference, I believe. And next year, it will be in Portland, Oregon, May 20th through the 22nd, I believe. And that's the way we organize that, so that it does cover our whole Northwest, including British Columbia.
And people submit papers that have a union interest, or what kind of papers usually come in from the academic world?
Well, we have papers coming in from academic world as well as workers. I mean, we're a multi-generational and multifaceted organization. We have trade unionists, union activists, rank-and-file members. We have academics, college professors, and university professors. We have students, all within our membership. And they're all welcome to submit an idea for a workshop. And it can be in the form of a paper or a film or, you know, a musical adaptation. We discourage people from standing up in front of the workshop and reading a paper. So it has to be a little more interpersonal and interactive.
Okay. I think that's what we needed to hear from you, Tom. And I think, do you have specific plans for the future of the organization?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm encouraging our members to recruit new members to get fresher ideas and to expand the organization. We're looking to get more involved in the invisible in the community. And as you know, Ross Reeder has put out, he's our past president, put out a labor history calendar every year. And we're wrestling with how we're going to continue putting out that calendar now that he's retiring. So those things are in the near future, and that's kind of the agenda right now. I know in Washington here, I've talked to our Washington vice president about the possibility of maybe sponsoring every other month or every 3 months of a labor movie, and also co-sponsor that with other organizations around the city or the state.
Okay, so you have big plans.
We hope to be out there and getting people involved.
If people are interested in checking our website, what would they look under?
Okay, it's www.pnlha.org.
Okay, and that's for the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and it's international. It's British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. I'm happy to be a member.
So am I.
Yeah, we got a couple at the table. Thank you very much, Tom, for calling in, and have a cool evening.
Yes, I'd like to ask Susan when I can get her new book.
It's on its way. So
okay,
probably sometime in the next week is what we're hoping.
The 23rd, the Washington State Labor Council is having its convention. I'd like to have some there.
Okay. I will make sure that you get some.
She'll be in
touch.
Well, thanks, Tom. Okay. Oh, wait, one more question.
If you need an exhibit, I'm going to offer myself a Nellie Fox. You said 47 years ago this started, and it did. And I want to say that Nellie and I worked pretty hard to get this into the university system and to get it funded, but I didn't realize 40 years had passed. I'm still so young. But if you if you need a dummy to stand there as an exhibit, I'll drag Nellie and the two of us will come down.
That'll be great.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Okay. The Pacific Northwest labor history has got a lot of action for this upcoming regime of Mr. Tom Lux, the newly elected president. So that was nice that you added your...
Yeah.
And we will get your membership, I'm sure.
I thought I was a member, so maybe I better check.
Yeah, we'll get back to you on that. So we were talking about technology and its effect on the workers and, well, life as we know it, I guess. And you've done some research, so let us know what you've
looked into. Well, picking up
on
Tom's point, showing movies, the labor movies that we've looked at the past are all dealing with organizing, getting rights for workers, making sure that they were paid a decent wage. And what I've been coming across is that, you know, labor may need to change its focus. Those movies may be wonderful old-time history, but in the rising technology, it isn't going to be a question of hours, wages, and working conditions. It's going to be a question of, does the worker have a job? Susan, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree with you. I guess my little... I know it's a very... customary to say we need to look at history so we can see what happened before and learn from that. But I think the real takeaway for those movies and for historical information is the fact, I think it should embolden us to feel that we too can make changes. Because when you see the context within which people were able to get things like worker safety and 8-hour day and the myriad of things that they've accomplished in our culture, it was the workers that did that. That did not come from the top 1% at the time. And so so the value in that really is for us to identify with our ancestors, realize that they had just as hard a row to hoe as we do today. Our monsters are different, but in some ways they're motivated by the same thing. Greed.
Right. Greed, yeah.
And the thirst for power.
Right. And courage is the word. I think the labor movement has never been anything but courageous. The problem with the coming technological wave is that the villains aren't so clear. It's kind of going to be hard to hate a robot. But jobs are going to be taken away. And one of the things that labor is going to have to focus on is, what do we do to redistribute wealth in the absence of jobs? Because the difference between the industrial age and the technological age is that the industrial age created jobs. You had assembly lines, you needed suppliers to support those.
And you had concentrated workforce.
That's right. But yeah. Nowadays, what's going to be replaced is service. And what is America but a service nation? It is not an industrial nation any longer. So that we even have now hotels that are replacing bellboys with electronic robots. So if we don't change the way we look at labor and how people are paid, people are not going to have a way of living decently in the economy. The tax code has to be changed. The distribution of wealth has to be changed through the tax code. Because if you don't have a job, how do you participate in the economy?
I do agree with that, but I also think that we have to talk about values. We have to come up with a consensus on what is a communal value for our culture. And I think we're moving towards that and evolving towards that. And I think the internet is helping that. I think we're getting a worldwide consensus of a compassionate value system rather than a greed-driven value system. But I think we have to do that as well.
And, well, Susan, how do you think that the unions can help with that kind of a cultural change around the way people work and the way the money goes to, you know, now that there's so many machines, where does the money go?
Well, I think one thing they can do is they need to do a better job of sort of working together to start putting out a value system and communicating that to folks. And I think that there are, as far as I'm concerned, unions are really the only organized force against the concentration of wealth, the mega corporations, the global corporations, because even though the numbers of workers are dwindling, the fact is that they are still, if they walk off the job, then there's a world of hurt for that corporation or that business. And so I think that that is the most powerful thing that we have to counteract basically the greed-driven corporations that are seizing the global economy.
Well, I agree with that, except in tomorrow's world, if workers get off the job, there are no consequences. China, for example, which has basically always been a worker society, has now embraced technology. And in one state alone, they are letting go 600,000 workers because they've mechanized. And so I wouldn't say, Susan, it's so much. I agree with you on the values. But labor has to educate the workforce about what is to come and how to combat it. What do we want? You know, what do we want? When do we want it?
What do you think the answer to that is? What do we want is the future?
Fewer work hours, and because I think that'll unleash a lot of creativity, and then wages that are living wages for those fewer hours. And that's a demand that was in existence 100 years ago. The carpenters were actually agitating for a 32-hour work week, and they said, if we just had more leisure time, we could do so much more in our community, for our families, artistically.
There's your point. You are hitting it on the nail. We have to redefine labor and its contribution to society, because it isn't going to be a 9-to-5 job.
Doesn't look like it. Looks like there's not enough to go around.
That's right.
Or there will be a very limited number of people that have full-time jobs in the old-fashioned way. So
that's right.
Where the unions are now, they're kind of disruptive. They're not connected to each other, and so they're getting hit in pockets. So
that's
how
right.
Do you see we could maybe work that out that would be to the benefit of the workers?
You know, the sad thing is we don't have a parliamentary system where you have the Labor Party and you have the conservative, you know, corporate party. And I'm not saying the Labor Party isn't, you know, in other countries with parliamentary system, but at least the Labor Party puts out a unified message about we want, and Australia is a great example, universal health care. They have universal car insurance. I mean, there's all sorts of things that they put out to make life better for the masses of people. And I think labor movement, labor unions in the United States need to kind of get on the stick, get together, and start doing that same kind of messaging.
Yeah, the unions have to organize. They have to organize themselves, because what they've got to do is train the labor force about what to expect. Because if you think you're going to just keep throwing coal into the engine of the steam engine, you're dead on arrival. And if you think it's just a matter of 9-to-5 and what the work hours are, you're dead on arrival. And the irony of it is that these machines are so capable nowadays that they can program and design themselves, and they're getting better. And remember this, the mandate of the private industry is to make profit for the stock owner. That's their legal, lawful mandate. They don't have to worry about the worker. And if the worker can be eliminated, they are so much better off in terms of what money is theirs and what isn't. So we have got to train them that they have to share.
Well, and the irony is so much of the money that's in the stock market is coming from the workers' pension funds.
Well, and that is the irony of
irony. But it is also
consumer economy, too.
And it also is the potential power because, and I think they showed that with apartheid in South Africa. So they just said, we want to divest from that. And it did have an impact. You know, unless you can change the underlying law, or unless you can hit them in their pocketbook, the greedy Gusses are going to continue to be the greedy Gusses, and they will be generation after generation. They hire people, they have replaceable people, and they keep the same steady tread towards consolidating and getting richer. That's what they're going to do. So we have to figure out how to intervene in that,
and that's and hurt exactly them there. What labor's mission should be. It cannot be behind the curve on this one.
Right, because we're losing rapidly.
Yes.
So some kind of consolidation of all, you know, workers of the world unite. Is that an old one?
Or is it coming back? Let's bring it back.
Is it coming back? Popular?
Well, they had a lot of good things. I mean, that's the thing that's really interesting is a lot of the solutions have been around for a long time, you know, basically since the rise of labor unions, you know, Karl Marx and all that, and his class analysis. Well, his class analysis predicted exactly what we're in. Whether you agree with how his class analysis was interpreted and then subsequently implemented, the fact is he was right on.
Another thing that labor needs to defend the people who are the workers is that these industries that are gathering big data are gathering big data on the worker, and that's how they're making their money. They are monetizing the worker, and we're taking no profit from that.
So you're talking about like when I go on Google, they're tracking what I'm interested in, and then they figure out how to push my buttons.
Exactly.
And sell it to other people.
There is a company, and I'm sorry, I can't think of the name of it right now, that is working on the technology that they can, with cameras, track your eyes to see where you're looking.
Oh.
So it has nothing, you don't even have to be on a computer anymore. What was that, the Minority Report, when Tom Cruise was walking through the mall? Do you remember all those ads saying, Tom, you want this? It's gone.
Subliminal advertising.
You know, fasten your safety belts, it's here.
You know, there was a great political economist named Bill Kreider, who talked about the fact that, you know, you can put the people out of work and you can consolidate the wealth in the hands of 1%, and you can do all that. But then as they produce these products, you've so destituted the workforce that they can't buy them. So in a way, it's like cutting off your nose to spite your face. It's a very short-term view of our culture.
And that's what the market is. It is a very short-term view, and that takes us to labor's role again. It doesn't have to be adversarial with the one percenters. As Susan points out, they have to craft the arguments to bring the nation together.
Yeah.
Because it's absolutely right. If you impoverish all of us, where's your profit coming from?
Well, and there also could be some sort of uprising. That's happened in the past.
Well, that's true, too.
We wouldn't want all the people out of jobs rising up and making
revolution
unsuitable demands, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I think the other thing is, and I think labor recognizes this, and they have, and they're trying to recognize that what happens to if you know, the plan is to now move to Africa, exploit Africa, and as a new market, and of course extract every value that they can get there, and if we have to sort of join hands with those folks, not see them as enemies, but see them as people, human beings that have the same needs and rights that we want. And so I think that's the other part. Labor has to have a global view, just like
global economy.
Yeah, capitalism has a global view.
Back to your point about who's expressing the human values in a technological age. Is that not labor's role? Has that not been its traditional role? But it's going to have to think differently than it seems to be at the moment.
Yeah. You know, one book I read, Kirkpatrick Sale wrote a book called Human Scale. And one point that he made that I thought was excellent was that he looked at agricultural communities, and the ones that were that had the individual family farms, he compared to the ones that were the corporate farms. Mm-hmm. And what he found in the towns that were the small family farms, or the family farms, was that they had much more cultural benefits. They had more libraries, they had more societies that helped each other, more Boy Scouts, everything. So when people have leisure time and enough money, and they're not just slave labor then, or labor slaves, or whatever, wage, yes, slaves, wage slaves, that's what I was looking for, then they blossom. And what's really human in all of us becomes more beautiful and productive, and I think that's what we need to look at.
Well, you know what? Our time is up.
Oh, and we were just on the verge of solving the world.
And solving the world's problems, yeah. Well, I'm thrilled you both came. I'm glad Tom called in, Tom Lux with the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, Carolyn Miller, a wonderful guest, and my co-host,
Lane's throwing her earphones through the room.
I'm throwing my earphones on the floor.
Yes. She got that excited.
Yes,
everyone.
Susan Stoner acted as our co-host, and I'm happy we were here, and we can wrap up tonight's show. You're listening to KBOO, the Labor Radio Show, and we're here every week from 6 to 6:30 Mondays. Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KBOO's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KBOO.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have